This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on the Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer podcast. This is your chance to connect with amazing experts, hear real life stories, and look behind the headlines too. It's all about the brain this week as we talk psychology hour and dementia. The effect on patients and the loved ones is something that cannot be underestimated and perhaps not even understood until you have a dementia sufferer in your family. We were speaking to Dubai resident Hannah about the heartbreaking moment she shared with her mum, who has a rare form of dementia, and also learning about the condition from Dr. Zachariah, consultant neurologist at the Sheikh Shaboud Medical City. And then on to ghosting. Not the spooky ghost stories, although this can be a little bit scary when someone just cuts off communication completely. It's not a modern day phenomenon, but modern dating apps have definitely caused something of an explosion in this behaviour. Dr. Thryer, clinical psychologist at the Human Relation Institute and Clinic, was on hand to explain why people do this. And we heard the real life story of Fiona Wishart, who has been on the front lines of the dating world and has even started a podcast about it.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us this afternoon. And today we're talking about something that some of you may be able to relate to. It's also the subject of a very popular movie that's putting dementia in the spotlight. The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman.
Date of birth?
Friday, 31st of December, 1937.
You're living with your daughter at the moment?
Yes, until she goes to live in Paris.
No, Dad, why do you keep going on about Paris?
You told me.
No, I didn't.
I'm sorry, Anne, you told me the other day. Have you forgotten? She's forgotten. Paris. They don't even speak English there.
And that confusing exchange might sound very real for those of you who have dementia sufferers in the family. Dubai resident Hannah is one of them. Her mother has the condition and she's been sharing her experience with me. And Hannah, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate the insights that that you're offering. And your Mother's Day post about your mum on Instagram was so, so beautiful and so well written. That I really wanted to hear your and, of course, her story as well. So can you tell us a little bit about when it was first suspected that your mum had dementia?
Yes, and thank you very much for having me and for covering such an important subject, which I've realised even more so following my post on Mother's Day is affecting so many people in all sorts of ways. So my story, yes, my mum is now 70, but she was actually diagnosed in her late 50s. With quite a rare form of dementia. When we think of dementia, a lot of people will default to thinking of Alzheimer's, which is common and something we know quite a lot about in terms of prognosis and expected behaviours and those sort of things. My mum has a form of dementia called semantic dementia. This shows itself at first in the inability to recall very common words. So, for example, she would struggle saying, "Pass me the ketchup." She wouldn't be able to say the word ketchup, or very everyday words that she would consciously be struggling with. So with this form of dementia, she has been aware the whole time, which has been one of the hardest things. She hasn't been oblivious to her condition, which has made this all the harder. Mm-hmm. Any form of dementia is hard, but watching someone so consciously and frustratingly lose the ability to conversate in an everyday way has been extremely hard. That was the first sign. So I'm going back about 12 years now. She was still working as a music teacher, which gradually got harder and harder. Of course, so much of teaching involves communication. Over the last 12 years, she has deteriorated, and we are now dealing with somebody who really can't grasp any conversation. Her sense of direction is okay. She can get up and get herself dressed in the morning. She can make her breakfast. She's not sort of doing mad things like forgetting to get dressed and walking out of the house, but she can't grasp day-to-day situations or conversations. So over the last 12 years, things have gradually deteriorated quite slowly to where we are today, when she's really at a point where her independence is probably we're just about saying goodbye to her independence.
Oh, Hannah,
so that's where we are now.
That's so young. That's so, so young. 70s young, but my goodness, a diagnosis in her late 50s. And what you're describing just sounds so cruel. You know, she's effectively trapped within that disease and things happening around her. And, you know, you said the word frustrating, and that sounds maddening. Maddening for an intelligent, capable woman to have that taken away from her.
Exactly that. And cruel is the word we hear so often when we're talking about dementia. And it is cliche, but it is the exact correct word to use. Because when somebody is okay in their physical form, but their brain is deteriorating, it is a terribly cruel thing to witness and for them to have to go through as well. And yes, she was incredibly young. Like I said, she was still working. I'm 34 now, so we're going back. I was in my early 20s, 21, and then my little sister's 5 years younger than me. So she was actually still at school. So when you think of the times that have been robbed from her, really, in terms of what she was looking forward to in retirement. And I've got a one-year-old daughter and another one on the way very, very soon. And, you know, their relationship with their grandmother is going to be very different from what I had hoped and what I had expected and imagined and what I had with my grandmother. So, yes, there are all these things that we're gradually coming to terms with and coping with every day.
What was her own reaction like to the diagnosis? How much do you think she understood back then, and what does she understand now, do you think?
At the time, she understood everything, as much as somebody saying, oh, you fractured your arm. She was very, very compos mentis, and actually was up until a couple of years ago. Still now, she will tell people, I have dementia. Sorry, I don't understand, I have dementia. It's her kind of security blanket. She'll tell people before they wonder, what's going on here then? You know, she's in the shops or something. Her reaction was incredible. My mum is a very, very strong woman, very practical and pragmatic. We've known from the start that there would be no cure, and we have known from the start that the prognosis had a great big question mark over it, because it's such a rare and under-researched form of dementia. We didn't know what her future was going to look like. Her first response was to do as much research as possible, and she found out that Cambridge University was running a huge, decades-long piece of research on this particular form of dementia, semantic dementia, and she signed herself up as one of the subjects.
Wow.
So this has been going on for 10 years. She's been every sort of 6 months, she checks in with them. Back in the day, she was driving herself off to Cambridge to go and take part in these studies. And her attitude was always, if we don't know much about it now, and if I can't benefit from any treatment or prevention, then hopefully I can help change that in the future, which is just the most incredible reaction.
It is. She's absolutely right. But to have that presence in the face of a life-changing diagnosis, I mean, that's ever the teacher, isn't it? Get the research done. Let's be practical. What an amazing woman. My goodness. My goodness. And, you know, you mentioned that you've got a little one, and, you know, the photos you shared on Instagram were to do with your wedding as well, which, you know, she was there, and my God, she's looking so beautiful and so bright-eyed and involved. How are you and the family coping with it? I mean, the emotional toll it takes on carers and loved ones can never, I'm sure, be truly understood until you're in that situation yourself.
Yeah, we're a small family. My sister and I are here in Dubai, so my dad is her sole carer day-to-day, if you like. Until maybe the last year, my mum has retained quite a lot of independence, which has really been the saving grace, and she's very determined to hang on to that. So she would take herself off to the week and do the weekly shop. She was even driving till relatively recently, which is one of the strange things when you look at the parts of the brain that are affected. Her ability to navigate roads and a car, that was all still working perfectly. So that was a real lifeline, that she had little moments in her day and week where she could do things a little bit more normally. Our attitude as a family has been to take things one day or month at a time, because we have no idea what the future will look like, how quickly or slowly things may progress, and try not to get overwhelmed by what the future might hold, because there is no way of knowing that. And to think that we've actually been coping with this for 12 years together is it doesn't sound possible when I say it out loud. And if someone had said you're going to still be dealing with this 12 years later upon diagnosis, that would have been too overwhelming. So I think try and live in the now and do what you need to do to get through the present moment you find yourself in.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us on this afternoon. I've been speaking to Hannah, who lives here in Dubai. Her mum, back in the UK, suffers from a rare form of dementia. She's been sharing her experience and would like to raise awareness to help the loved ones and the families of people suffering with the condition. She says one of her big learnings is trying to be in the moment as much as possible.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And when I speak or am with my mum now, I think, my goodness, so much of her has gone, but you know, in a year or two, it's going to be even worse. So the one bit of advice that I wish I had done more of, I mean, we're all connected in social media and my phone's full of photos and videos, but you can never have too many of them. And when I look back to 10, 12 years ago, I think, oh, I wish I had a little bit more, maybe videos of us speaking to understand how things have changed. And again, it's just hindsight. You don't think of it until you realise that you don't have them. But part of me now thinks, oh, I wish there was just a video of me speaking to my mum to understand and remember what it was like to have a conversation with her. So I think if you feel comfortable to document your time with that person, not necessarily sharing it on social media, but something to look back on, because I think they're going to be such precious memories as things probably inevitably get worse. That would be my piece of advice, as well as finding people who understand what you're going through. Again, a very cliche piece of advice, but I have recently found a wonderful support group based in Dubai, where we meet once a month, and everybody's got very different stories, but especially here, where a lot of us are away from our family, it's important to have people who understand, just to talk. No one's going to fix anything, especially with dementia. There's not much that can be done, and the feeling of hopelessness is really one of the toughest parts of coping with this, because your immediate reaction is that you want to help. What can I do? And there really is nothing. And you have to look after yourself and find a space where you can talk about everything you're going through and have people around you who are nodding their heads and completely understand. Even though they can't say anything or necessarily offer words of comfort, it's having a space where you can share. Very, very important.
It sounds a bit like what you're describing is a kind of grief. And I guess that must be, you know, the grief of, you know, you mentioned of saying goodbye to the relationship you thought you might have with your mum as she got older, and trying to let go of the hopes that, you know, your children growing up with her as well. And I think that's spot on, to be honest, you know, to adjust those expectations. And I think that support aspect, thank you for raising that. It's because I'm sure amazing friends, amazing partner, but everybody's coming with it through their own lens, to have someone who can truly empathize because they're living it or have lived it, or to have someone who's completely impartial who can just let you offload, and must be so, so important. And I thank you for flagging that, because it's not a sign of weakness. If anything, it's a sign of strength to have people around you, because you need that. And well done for acknowledging it. What are your hopes, really, for the next few years? What are you expecting to unfold? And I know COVID must be throwing a tremendous spanner in the works of when you can see her again.
Yeah, I was due to go home in February on my own just for a week to spend with my mum and dad and kind of assess how things were and put some things in place for kind of have a B and C plan for worst case scenarios. And, you know, something happens to my dad, what will we do? My sister and I are here. And I think firstly, we need to reassess things from a very practical point of view. So we'll be going home in the summer with the new baby, to sort some of those things out. The wonderful thing with my mum is that she was a music teacher and she still enjoys music so much. we see this a lot. You see these viral videos going around on social media where somebody who isn't able to have a conversation can sit down at a piano and play a piece of music they learned 50 years ago. That is my mum. It's really incredible and painful to watch that one part and to witness one part of the brain working so wonderfully, doing something that so many people couldn't do. So I want to ensure that when things reopen, that she still has music in her life. My dad was a music teacher as well, so that's such a lifeline for them, and that we can share some of those moments together. That gives her a real boost. And I think if we get to spend, hopefully travel allows, if we get to spend a few months at home with the new baby and my daughter Ivy, that will be really, really special memories to make. And we'll give her a boost as well. So I'm not looking any further than the end of the year for now, but those are the two things that I'm hopeful for.
I'm hopeful as well, Hannah. Thank you again for being with us this afternoon. And she sounds like an absolutely amazing woman, and huge credit to your dad and to you girls as well. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you, Helen.
Thanks, Hannah.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That is Hannah there, whose mum is suffering from dementia.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
The toll that dementia or Alzheimer's disease can take on a family is limitless. No one can predict how fast a loved one will go downhill or the care plans that are needed, and the emotional fallout can be huge. While certain types of dementia are hereditary, some new research suggests that up to 40% of dementia cases could be prevented or delayed by adopting some simple lifestyle changes. To talk to us about dementia here in the UAE, internationally, and offer up some treatment ideas, plus the changes we can all make to lessen our chances of getting dementia, delighted to be joined by Dr. Zachariah Mash, consultant neurologist at the Sheikh Sabut Medical City. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us today. I think your job must be incredibly difficult because there's such a emotional side to a diagnosis like Alzheimer's dementia. So thank you for your time. Before we get into some of the symptoms, I'd really like you just to set the scene a little bit. How common is dementia here in the UAE?
There are no data about the prevalence or the number of patients affected with the disease. But what I can tell you, two important points. The first one, that, you know, with the advanced medical care that we are providing to patients in the UAE, people are living longer and longer. And one of the main factors in patients with dementia or Alzheimer's disease is the age. Mm-hmm. Secondly, people are more and more aware about Alzheimer's disease. At the beginning, people used to say, he is forgetting because he is getting old or she is getting old. Now, people know what's Alzheimer's disease, what's dementia. So they are seeking medical attention to try to take care of their family member.
Can I ask a simple question that might seem very kind of bread and butter to you, but might not be so clear to the rest of us? What is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? Are they the same thing, or how do you characterize them?
This is not a simple question. This is a very
sorry,
good...
doctor.
This is a very good question. Let me tell you, dementia is an umbrella it's a bag that contains a lot of disease. Alzheimer's disease is part of this bag. Vascular dementia is part of this bag. Frontotemporal dementia is part of this bag. Dementia is the big name for all those dementia. And then you have several subgroups like Alzheimer's, vascular, frontotemporal dementia, and other types of dementia.
Are you able to explain a little bit about some of the common behavioural or medical characteristics that you might see in a patient presenting with dementia?
We are having tendency every time we are searching for a patient if they have dementia or not, is to check their memory. Definitely, memory is an important key factor in making the correct diagnosis of dementia. However, there are other types of dementia where the memory can be doing okay, like frontotemporal dementia, or those patients will have more behavioral abnormality than memory problem. In patients with Alzheimer's disease, that is usually disease that occur in people above 60 or 65, they start having their symptoms very progressively. And this is why we call it neuroprogressive degenerative disorder. It's very important for everyone to know that dementia is a progressive disease. It's over years and years, the progression of the disease. They present with some very minimal or mild memory disturbances. They start forgetting few things. As the disease progresses, the memory disturbances get worse and worse. with the progression of the disease, their activity of daily living will start being affected. And then the family starts noticing that there's something problem, a problem somewhere, I mean, and they take them to the physician.
Well, and can I ask you how you diagnose? Because you mentioned there the family perhaps noticing at some point there could well be hidden behaviours, or it's not a case of doing simple blood tests, I assume. How on earth do you manage to reach a diagnosis?
It's very important to say something. One of the main symptoms of people with Alzheimer's disease is something called anosognosia, where the patient do not know or do not realize that they are having memory problem. And this is why the family member, whenever they start noticing that there is a problem around them, mm-hmm. they have to take them to be seen by a doctor. Once they are being seen by the doctor will start digging to know exactly if this patient has been having some memory problem in a way that they are repeating the same question again and again. They are telling the same story several times. Mm-hmm. Because keep in mind that the patient with dementia or Alzheimer's disease, they have a short-term memory that's being affected, which means that they will forget what they had for breakfast or what they had for dinner or someone that they met 1 hour or half an hour ago. However, they are still able to tell you a story that happened 20 years ago. So you start by doing what you call a clinical diagnosis, by doing what we call mini mental status exam to check how bad is their memory affected. Once you start doubting or confirming that there is a problem somewhere, there are investigations that has to be done. First of all, we need to do an MRI of brain, and this not to make the diagnosis, to make sure that there are no other possibility that can be responsible or etiology that can be responsible for the memory problem. We have also to do blood tests, mainly vitamin B12 and TSH. Mm-hmm. Because if the patient is having any lack in vitamin B12 or if the thyroid gland is not functioning well, it can induce also memory problem. Number three, we have to check on the medication. There are certain number of medication that can also induce memory disturbances. And sometimes just by stopping those medicine, we'll be able to improve the memory complaint of those patients.
I mentioned before, Doctor, that we know there's a hereditary aspect to dementia. What about some of the lifestyle impacts as well? You know, new research suggesting that there are some ways that you can adopt some lifestyle changes that could improve your chances of, you know, boosting your memory and staying mentally well for as long as possible. What is your research, and even anecdotally, what have you seen in patients?
Unfortunately, there is no consensus among doctors about what is the best way to go to prevent dementia. What we know for sure that whenever we stay healthy, which means you don't smoke, drink occasionally, or you don't drink at all, you do exercise. If you have hypertension, diabetes, or cholesterol, you take care of them. This will prevent you from having, or will help you to delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease or dementia if you do have it. But exercising, using their brain, you know, there are a lot of studies that show that people who use their brain by playing chess or reading a lot or interacting, it can help. But there is no uniform consensus between doctors about what we should do to prevent Alzheimer's or dementia.
The sensible stuff, really. Keep your weight at a healthy level. Get some exercise, good sleep, good diet. Stop smoking, reduce alcohol consumption. Right. All the stuff that we know, and obviously having a good, healthy diet as well. What about the social side? Have we seen anything to do with having a busy social life, you know, warding off dementia, you know, making sure you're having social interactions?
This is another very good question. This not only is helpful before the onset of the disease, but also after the onset of the disease. This is why I always recommend to my patients who are having mild to moderate form of memory disturbances, I insist on the family, they should not be staying at home. When you are having early Alzheimer's disease or dementia or mild or even up to moderate stage, it's very important they don't stay home. The more they interact with their surroundings, better will be the long-term outcome. The more you sit and be to them or discuss with them, better it's going to be. So the social activity is important before the disease and during the early stage of the disease.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking dementia today with Dr. Zira Manch, a consultant neurologist at the Sheikh Shagbut Medical City, and he has advice for loved ones looking after dementia sufferers in their family.
It's a big burden. It's very hard. You don't want to believe how much usually caregiver, especially children of the patient, suffers when they see mom or dad are having memory problem. What I usually tell them the most important part, that the people who are more suffering in the whole story is you guys, not the patient by themselves. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, with time, as the disease progresses, the patient will not be aware about the surroundings anymore. And unfortunately, the caregiver, especially a family member, will be suffering more and more because they are looking at their mom and their dad trying to help them, and they are unable to help them. Unfortunately, there is a percentage of patients, whatever you do, is going to get worse and worse. What I usually try to tell those people, don't worry, mom and dad are not suffering. Mom and dad, they are already demented and they are not really realizing what's around them. Try to take it as easy as you can. You want to stay with them, stay with them. You want to take care of them. Sure, you can take care of them. But just put in your head the idea that they are not suffering. The people who are suffering now is you.
I think that's really useful, actually, and probably a huge source of comfort to many people who are in that situation, Doctor. So thank you for that. I know you are a consultant neurologist, and I just wondered what kind of progress we're seeing around treatment and care when it comes to dementia. When we talk about treatment, is it really about management right now?
Medication-wise, we do have 4 to 5 medications that they are available. All of them are available in the UAE, which is very good. As far as I know, there is nothing coming soon, neither in the U.S. Nor in Europe. But the medicine that we are having now, it's true that they will not cure the patient, but they can help in delaying the progression or slowing down the progression of the disease.
For anyone who is listening and might be worried about a family member or perhaps about their own symptoms, what do you think the first port of call should be? Who should you go and see as an expert to get the help that you need and even reach a diagnosis?
Oh, my big advice for everyone is that whenever you are having someone in your family or even yourself or a relative that you feel that he starts having memory problem and he is above the age of 60, take him to be seen by a neurologist. Even if it turns out to be nothing, it's better to take him, do the blood test, do the MRI, and then say there is nothing. Because the earlier you start the treatment, better will be the outcome. So for everyone who is listening to us, please, whenever you are feeling that anything is wrong, take the patient to be seen by a neurologist as soon as you can.
And Doctor, lastly, based on all of the patients that have come through your door, all the research that you have done and that your peers have done, is there anything that you do or take or eat or anything that you do to try and keep your brain as healthy as possible? It could be anything from doing a Sudoku to certain supplements.
I wish I would have done it to myself. Like we said, only exercise, stop smoking, having a healthy life. This is the most important. But there is no medicine that can be taken. I mean, only quality of life or hygiene of life, this will help us to protect our brain.
Dr. Zakaria, thank you so, so much. Really appreciate you being with us. Dr. Zakaria joining us from the Sheikh Shabut Medical City. Thank you so, so much, sir, and wishing you and all your patients all the very best for the coming months ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this afternoon. It is our psychology hour. Ghosting, which means cutting off all communication without offering an explanation, has only kind of recently entered popular lexicon, but it's a behaviour likely as old as human interaction have ever existed. People have been pulling disappearing acts for years. Famed mystery writer Agatha Christie disappeared for 11 days in 1926, only to be found at a Yorkshire spa, checked in, and the name Teresa Neal. She refused to speak of the incident and divorced her husband 2 years later. Curious. The term originated, of course, in the context of dating, but ghosting occurs across friendships and even becoming a notable trend in professional relationships as well. It is a strange behaviour. Why would anyone treat someone as heartlessly that they recently liked or leave work with so much of an "I quit" scribbled on a sticky note? That's what we're talking about this afternoon. What drives this behaviour? Are some people more likely than others to choose ghosting over other strategies to end a relationship? And what is the impact of ghosting on the haunted? It isn't a new phenomenon. We just have a name for it and a few new platforms to be rejected on. Joining us to discuss is Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist from the Human Relation Institute and Clinic. Already a number of messages on this, Thuraya. I've spoken to single friends and it seems increasingly common, if not pretty normal. Why do you think we do it? Psychologically speaking, what rationale can you find?
Well, actually, it's really interesting because one of the most significant reasons why people ghost is fear of communicating and or confronting. And it's almost like a form of avoidance to the uncomfortable thoughts and feelings that might actually come up when you have to discuss something that you may find a little bit difficult with somebody else. And so that seems to be the number one reason why people usually engage in ghosting. But at the same time, some people, you know, also engage in ghosting because they may not necessarily want to feel rejected, mm-hmm. And so they reject other people first. Or it's almost like a manifestation of their flight response whenever they feel like they're in an uncomfortable and anxious situation.
Speaking of uncomfortable situations, it just seems to be perhaps on the rise. And as I kind of alluded to, there are many more platforms on which to be rejected on right now. But it's not just dating. It does seem to be quite a normal way of ending a relationship. But whether it is dating or friendships, do you feel like some people are more prone to this behavior?
Yes, interestingly enough, I mean, if you want to talk gender-wise, men tend to engage in ghosting a lot more than women do. However, the statistics are not very different from each other. So you're only talking about maybe a 7% increase in men that ghost over women that ghost. So really, men and women both tend to do that. Now, in terms of personality, though, you'll find individuals who are kind of people pleasers, extremely sensitive in nature, those that tend to think of themselves a lot more highly than others. They feel like, you know, they're entitled to kind of just walking away without explaining anything to anybody. And then you also have those individuals that have a fear of confrontation. So in essence, like, there are different reasons why. I would definitely add one to the reasons that are out there. And I would say that some individuals that have this tendency because everything is online. So what ends up happening is that we forget how to empathize with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so individuals who are not very empathetic in nature, especially when they're on an online platform, tend to ghost far more than a person who tends to have a lot more empathy.
Interesting. And I think that face-to-face, you know, it could be a case of interacting for ages on an app and then the next person comes along. And because mm-hmm. you haven't engaged face-to-face, it's presumably quite a lot easier just to reject someone because they don't really exist in 3D to you. It's, you know, it's like interacting with an avatar, with a screen, with a computer. And what can I ask you about the impact it can have on the person who is ghosted? And as I said, this seems to be pretty normal behavior. And it's... It happens time and time again. So why are certain people perhaps more affected by being ghosted?
Well, if you really think about it, Helen, one of the most difficult things about being ghosted is this idea of confusion. There's so much ambiguity because you don't know what happened. You know, you don't know if the person fell off the face of the earth. You don't know if something bad happened to them. You really don't know anything. And so that level of ambiguity can cause a lot of anxiety, a lot of confusion. There's so many unanswered questions. But then equally, it's likely to trigger anger and pain for the individual because for them, it's just a matter of, like, what did I do? Was it something I said? There's also this level of feeling disrespected, discarded. You know, it could impact a person's self-esteem and make them actually doubt themselves or even doubt their judgment of other people, and let alone, you know, people feeling abandoned or developing trust issues because, you know, and I'm sure you've heard of horror stories where people have, you know, either been dating or developed friendships online for quite some time, and then all of a sudden the person completely disappears with no explanation, with no reasoning, with nothing. And that can leave a person feeling very disoriented.
So many messages coming in on this, across friendship and relationships, actually. Some have been ghosted. Some are the ghosters. Sally said, I've read messages from guys I've given my number to in a club years ago and never replied. It's a bit different when it's a relationship, though. Sally, you're not alone. I've got numbers stored, even now, from my old phone, like Dan Barasti, do not pick up. I think that's a little bit different. Angelina saying, I met a great guy, had some great dates over the course of 7 or 8 weeks. Then he was going away with his family for a big celebration, and I never heard from him again. About 8 years later, 8 years, you added me on as a friend on Facebook. I don't think so. Fair enough. A question here saying, had great chat with a girl online for months. I was stuck abroad, got back, went on a date and never heard from her again. Either my dress sense wasn't to her taste or my chat in real life wasn't up to much that night. And I think that actually addresses a really interesting point, because surely experiences like this do chip away at self-confidence and lead to assumptions like that, you know. You know, did she hate my dress sense? Was, you know, these kind of bizarre assumptions that we make, that if it happens repeatedly, that must get really damaging.
Of course. And, you know, interestingly enough, when you mentioned that, there was a survey that was actually done in the United States with over 1,500 people, where they found that the number one reason for both women and men ghosting was because, like, they wanted to avoid confrontation. But the second reason, and mostly from men as well as women, was people ghosted people for not living up to their profile pictures.
Ooh,
so imagine
false advertising.
Exactly. So on some level, this is not to say that that's what happened with this person, but it's just these expectations that we usually have from, you know, chatting online, especially because, you know, even if the person doesn't or does look like their profile picture, when you're having a conversation with someone online, you're not reading some of the most important cues, nonverbal cues, mm-hmm. in that individual, or their tone and their messaging, you know, and things
pheromones,
like that.
You know.
Exactly, exactly. And so when you see the person face to face and all of that stimulus is coming at you, you might take it in a very negative way. But unfortunately, what's happening is, instead of people kind of, like, you know, gathering the strength and really the respect and the courage to just tell somebody, you know, listen, thank you very much, but I'm just not interested anymore, what's happening is that we are feeling the sense of it's okay for me to just not respond or
it's
not reply.
Not okay. People do better. Linda saying narcissistic personality disorder. W saying, I hate this behavior. Wish I could say it was something younger people do, but I was dating a guy for a few months and he just disappeared. He's 44. It's so pathetic. And a completely different take on this, and a different experience I'd like to share. No name on this message on 4001 saying, I've done this, but I can explain. My friends from school all having babies, building lovely friendships and families, while I kept having miscarriages. I pulled away, stopped sending messages, slowly got back in touch, and they were kind enough to re-include me. Then sometime later, they all seemed to get pregnant with their second at the same time. And instead of being mature and saying something like, I need a break, one day I just turned off WhatsApp. And then before I knew it, it'd been a month and then a year. One of them tried writing to me. I'm sure from their point of view, I just ghosted them for no reason. I still feel guilty about it and I don't know how to fix it. I'm so sorry you went through that, and I completely understand wanting to withdraw and to not feel able to offer up an explanation. What would you advise here about kind of building bridges when you feel like you've done someone wrong, but because of a really difficult situation?
You know, obviously that situation could not have been easy. And even within the message itself, like when she said, I ghosted people, but let me explain, she recognized that what she had done wasn't necessarily the right thing for her to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, owning that is so important, because when you have true friendships, your friends will understand and they will forgive, and it won't even be something that they'll need to forgive. It'll be an unspoken thing. It'll just be like, okay, you know what? It happened. Now we can move on. But when you don't own up to the things that you do, what ends up happening is that you leave people with this bad taste in their mouth that, like, that they did something wrong. And then trying to build a bridge without owning that makes them feel like, no, like, after all this time, you can't just come and disrespect me again. I'm not going to put my trust in you again. And that's where things get complicated. So communication is really important when it comes to things like that. And, you know, it's interesting, because with ghosting, like I said, the number one reason is usually this idea of confrontation. And unfortunately, confrontation has this really negative connotation. People think of confrontations and they think of fighting and they think of arguments and they think of, like, name calling and things like that. But a confrontation is simply a conversation where people might have differing opinions. And when you think of something like that, it becomes so much easier in terms of having a quote-unquote difficult conversation.
Mm-hmm. Samir saying, I feel recently that people I've grown up with or even family members have nothing in common with me anymore, or their views are totally different to mine, sometimes hurtful views. It's me that's changed. I know that. I see their social media posts. And even if we've met previously, I just don't view the same world anymore. I don't want to challenge it. It's not worth the argument. So I can understand why people ghost. No name on this one saying, I was engaged many years ago before mobile phones. He was in the military. I was in college. Everything seemed fine. We were exchanging weekly letters and talking whenever we got the chance. I sent him a card for his birthday and it was returned to me. Called his mother. She was very vague. Finally tracked him down. He told me he was married. He had just visited me 6 months before, so I was confused and devastated. And we're talking earlier about that conflict and wanting to avoid it. But sometimes it's the lack of closure that absolutely wrecks your head. It leads to all of those awful questions. And sometimes it's to do with immaturity, them not being able to deal with a situation that you are in, or being able to deal with the fact that they don't want to be in a relationship or friendship with you anymore. Peter's been in touch saying, in 2018, I was ghosted by an old friend, met him at university in 1985. After I informed him my second wife was diagnosed with grade 3 breast cancer, same chap, best man at our wedding, I've lost respect. My wife, thankfully, now in remission, life goes on. And you know what, Peter, sometimes it can be a test of friendship in some ways. And I'm sorry that you went through that. I wanted to ask you about a question that came in to do with friendship and feeling rejected. No name when it's saying, how many times should I try to arrange coffee with a friend? She's been so positive, but never actually making a time or date. I've tried offering days, weeks in advance and stuff I know she enjoys, but I don't seem to get anywhere. Do I need to take the hint? What would you advise, Dr. Thry? Someone is being ghosted. Well, not even being ghosted, but maybe being misled.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because when it comes to something like that, we have our own misconceptions, right? So from hearing just that basic statement, that basic message, we all kind of think, oh, okay, you know, you're trying so hard and this person's obviously not putting in the effort, so just kind of like walk away. But there could be so many things in the background that we don't know of, right? So one of the things that I usually recommend quite significantly is communicate. You know, if you feel you are trying really hard with a friend and the friend is not putting in the effort, say something. Because if you say something and your friend finally like owns up to it and says, look, listen, I'm really sorry, but this is what's been happening in my life right now, and I just don't feel like I have the bandwidth or I'm in the headspace to kind of really connect with anybody at this time, and I promise you when I am ready, I will reach out to you. You've done enough. You know, then that's a great scenario. Or you can have a person come back to you and be like, oh, you know what, you know, I just haven't had the time and whatever, and you can kind of read into that as well. But before you jump to conclusions and you make assumptions and you take any decisions, it's important to communicate. And I know this is so difficult for so many people because
it's so awkward sometimes.
It can be, absolutely. You know, I definitely agree that it can be extremely awkward. But in the end, you could be losing a potentially very good and lifelong friend just because you want to avoid an uncomfortable or awkward situation or awkward conversation. And sometimes one of the things, I mean, not sometimes, actually, one of the things that I say consistently about therapy is that we only make our best changes when we are challenged in the most significant ways. And we don't really make the changes that we need in our life unless we get frustrated, unless something bothers us. And in this kind of a situation, this is something that bothers us. And if we actually tackle it rather than avoid it, it's more likely to help us move forward and progress. And even if the person says something like, you know what, I just don't really want to be friends, or this is just not my thing, or I'm not interested, or whatever it is, you will feel a sense of comfort and accomplishment within yourself that at least you gave it what you could, and it didn't work out, and it's okay.
Yeah, you put on your big girl or boy pants and tackle that situation head on, which it sounds like you'll have more guts than a lot of people out there. Dr. Thry, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. Really, really appreciate it. And talk to you soon.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
To give us the no-holds-barred truth about modern dating, and yes, ghosting in particular, I'd like to be joined now by Fiona Wishart. She is the co-founder with her friend Georgie Bradley, a journalist, of a new podcast called Love Bites, which is definitely adult content about the real side of what goes on past the Tinder dates and perhaps, Fiona, when messages are not responded to. So who better to ask about what is going on the front lines of modern dating. Before we get into ghosting, can I ask you, why did you feel like there was a bit of a gap in the market when it comes to a podcast about dating?
That's so funny that you say it's the front lines, because it is kind of love is a war. So we just, do you know how it started? So Georgie and I would voice note each other about our dating lives. Because the thing is, so I'm 30, Georgie's 30, and you get to that age where people are kind of in long-term relationships, they're getting married, and we're still single. And it is such a really, it's like an ocean to navigate your way through. And we were speaking about all these things, and, you know, we have so many stories, and so many of my friends, and, you know, we have these stories, but no one really has a platform to talk about it and it to make you feel like you're not alone. Because, you know, if I something embarrassing happened, or, you know, a guy ghosted me, I would then speak to a friend and they said, oh, that happened to me. And then you suddenly don't feel so alone. Like, you don't feel so bad about yourself.
Well, honestly, so, since I mentioned the fact that we're talking about ghosting today, every single person I know has been ghosted or has ghosted somebody. So it seems to be very much a modern, well, just a part of dating right now.
It is.
What do you think it's all about? And do you feel like there's any kind of, we've been speaking to Dr. Thryer about the kind of the reasons about avoiding conflict and that kind of thing. But what do you think it comes down to?
So I think with ghosting, there's two sides of it. Either the person who is ghosting you, or if you're the ghoster, either you feel you don't owe the person anything, which is in some sense could necessarily be true if it's a first date, for example, and then you don't feel like you owe the person anything. Or it's simply exactly what you said, they don't want the conflict, they don't want to hurt the other person. But I think it's quite damaging to do that, because it puts people in quite a kind of exposed way where they don't know what's going on. So it can really derail you, and you wonder, like, for example, you know, the first time I got ghosted, I was 23 and I went on two dates with this guy and then I never heard from him again. And I was quite young at the time and I had never been ghosted before. I didn't know what was going on. And I went through this huge thing, being like, oh my goodness, did I do something wrong? Did I double dip my spring roll? Like, did I look funny? Was I sweating? Like, all
so,
these things.
So it created
all
a huge amount of
drama.
Amount of doubt.
Totally. It's a self-doubt thing. And I think that also what's awful about ghosting and all these things, you know, when someone phases you out and they don't basically tell you, it comes down to not telling you the real reason why they don't want to be with you. You then start doubting yourself. It's their problem. It's always what's my problem. And that can be such a damaging thing for young women and also men as well. Like, it's not just it's a human thing to doubt yourself. And it takes a very secure person. And that can take a lot of years of self introspection to suddenly be like, do you know what? It's not me. It's actually them. They might have a lot of problems, but, you know, why we wanted this platform is because it's to help people feel like it's never you, it's never you. And also, it's okay if someone's not that interested in you. Like, that's okay. I'm not always interested in everyone, but it just, I really want there to be try and make a movement for people to actually say something and be like, do you know what? I had a really great time, but you're not the person for me. And then you feel so much better. I've had guys say that to me, and I've been like, do you know what? Thank you.
Cool. Same.
That's fine.
Let's move on.
Move on. Instead of like sitting there for hours in my bedroom going, oh my God, did I have a spot? I don't know. Like, there's all
and
this
also, let's just take a moment to acknowledge if this is the person for you, they wouldn't care that you had a spot. I mean, they might care about the double dipping. I do judge the double dipping. So I think you're absolutely right. It's about not necessarily normalizing this behavior, but understanding that this is a really big part of what is kind of going on out there. And in terms of the topics that you're tackling, what is on your hit list for episodes you've done already and future episodes?
So we talk about, first of all, you know, dating in a pandemic, I think is obviously, you know, we're still in a pandemic and how to navigate that, because this is actually something that we're going to be talking on our next episode about compromises in dating. Do men really move mountains if they want to be with you? Is that a thing? You know, we talk about if a man has children, that was quite a sensitive topic. We of course talk about dating. How the format works is we read out stories and advice from our listeners, and we have had some amazing stories come through where they're so funny, and then we kind of dissect them. So that's the kind of, I would say it's more just navigating the dating scene, and then we kind of talk about different topics that evolve around that. So yeah, ghosting, breadcrumbing,
what?
Phasing someone out, gaslighting. So breadcrumbing, I'll explain it to you super quickly. Breadcrumbing is actually a really, it's a new word that's come around where basically a man or a girl is keeping you there in a holding pattern. So they're not fully committing, but they're kind of throwing you breadcrumbs that you take back to your home and make a feast out of to your friends. But really, it's nothing, and he'll never commit. I know, it's so sad. It's so sad, and I've had it so many times. I've had so many times, and only now I've realized and looked back and been like, what was I doing? But I'm not alone, and I know that, you know, 1,000 girls are not alone in this either. People really struggle, and you have to really know yourself to navigate your way. And I think only until you know yourself 100% will you be able to find someone and connect with another human. That's my view on it anyway. And so we do talk about all this, and we talk very much about the sociological elements of dating and about attachment styles and things like that. And I mean, I would love to get a kind of relationship therapist on to talk to us about it as well. Hopefully, fingers crossed, one day.
Fiona, can I ask you, what's the worst ghosting story you've heard?
Oh, I don't know if this is the worst one. The same guy, actually, that I mentioned in the first section.
The initial ghoster.
What he would do was, he ghosted me, and then he would resurrect himself and come back, and I would be like, oh my goodness, I'm so happy he's back. And then he would talk to me and be like, oh, should we meet up? And I'd say, yes, I would love to. And then he would disappear.
Oh,
it's so strange. And I was
that's not strange. Well, it's horrible behavior, but that's him being like, ego boost. Is she?
Oh, 100%.
No, not cool.
He once invited me to a wedding in Australia. Like this beautiful wedding, and then I was like, yes, I'd love to go, and then I never heard from him. It was so strange. It's so strange. Thing is with ghosting, like, there's not so much a degree of how bad it can be, because when someone cuts the contact, they cut the contact. It's more just like, I would actually say that someone breadcrumbing you, this holding pattern, is almost worse.
Yeah, that does sound really damaging.
Really damaging.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai i 103.8.
In conversation with Fiona Wishart, the co-founder of Love Bites, a podcast about modern love and dating. We've been talking ghosting, and she's had her fair share of ghosting experiences. Here's the rest of our chat.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ghosting's not a new thing. You know, this has been, as long as humans have been communicating, whether that is through letter, carrier pigeon or whatever, there's always someone that, sometimes it fizzles out, sometimes it's in friendship. I have got a really bad one that was pre-dating apps, if you want to hear it. I'll try and remove any identifying details, but the person is no longer in Dubai. And she met a guy on a night out, started having a relationship. He moved back to the UK. She took him to the airport, yada, yada, yada. Only to see his mates on a night out 2 weeks later. And he hadn't moved back to the UK.
You're joking.
No, full life ghost had said that he'd got a new job, and I was like, oh, that's just not even replying to a message. Funny. She took him to the airport. I mean,
it's like going to Yemen in that
15 Yemen Road, Yemen.
Yemen.
Oh, Fiona, it is a war zone out there. What advice would you give to anyone who's been recently ghosted? And we're laughing now about the extreme side of it, but if someone is really like genuinely disappointed, thinking something was going to go somewhere and is living now in a bit of a state of confusion, what would you say?
So my advice would be to look at if you're upset about it and you've gone on 2 or 3 dates, one date, 2 to 3 dates, and they've ghosted you, you don't know that person. So actually what you're upset about is your future self that was going to go on all these further dates. And girls are great at creating fantasies in our minds, but that's all they are, they're fantasies. In actual fact, it was probably better that he did this now, because he just was never the right guy for you. And I think that's what you have to think about. Like, although you'll feel terrible, and it's fine to feel terrible for, a couple of days, look back and be like, do you know what? I didn't actually know him. I only went on 2 dates. We only spent a maximum of like 8 hours total together. That's not that long. And I'm upset for my future self that she didn't get to have a great time. And also, he wasn't the right guy for me, because like you said, the right guy would never have done that. The right guy won't ghost you. He won't breadcrumb you. He will say to you quite upfront, I really want to be with you, and it shouldn't be hard. And I always find that Georgie always says this. She says that the litmus test is anxiety. If you're sitting there stressing about something, even if you've got a second date and you're stressing and you're worrying and you're checking your phone and going, oh my God, he hasn't messaged me. Oh my gosh, he hasn't messaged me. He's probably not the right guy for you, because the right guy, it should be easy breezy. And he should never make you feel insecure. And when you feel insecurity, then you're not in a position where you're going to give your full self, because you'll be worrying about other stupid things like, oh my gosh, does my hair look frizzy or whatever it is, which is not how it should work.
You are so right. And I had some pretty dark years in the Dubai dating pool. Thankfully.
Oh, yeah.
Thankfully, pre-dating. And
I've got a lovely husband.
I have got a lovely husband. We met here on a blind date. Setups work, by the way. And that's exactly right. It's from the first date. There was no game playing. It was just very easy. I'm a firm believer that if a relationship or even dating is a source of drama and angst, then to me, when you're with the right person, everything is better. You're happier. Everything is easier.
I completely agree.
And
agree.
Maybe kiss a few frogs, male or female, in the meantime to get there.
Georgie and I were just discussing the kissing a few frogs. We were just like, how many frogs are we going through? Like, where is he? Come on now. It's been 30 years.
Fiona, for anyone who wants to check out your chats, the podcast Love Bites, what's the best way of finding it?
So we are on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, Love Bites with Georgie and Fee. And you can email us in your stories or advice at info@lovebitespodcast.com. Or you can find us on Instagram at lovebitespodcast_.
And yes, it can get a little bit fruity. So not one to listen to you with the kids. Fiona, really appreciate your honesty today. Thank you so much. Go forth, go date, have fun. And
thank you, I will do.
Keep us posted.
Will do. Thanks, Helen.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thanks again for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We are live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. It's our psychology hour every single Tuesday. And please do rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boosts us in the ratings. And of course, you get it straight to your phone as soon as it's out.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.